Russell, and good afternoon to you. And that big sigh right there was from my guest today. It's good old Matt McAuliffe. Matt is, well, he's kind of worship coordinator there, Trail Christian Fellowship. And usually when Matt comes in, he's accompanied by Chris White. But Chris is not here today. He's unable to be with us. He is admittedly out of town. He's pretty far out of town. And considering the time difference, we were just waxing lyrical as to what he might be doing.
My suspicion, Pat, is even as we speak, he's watching the sun go down as he and his wife either stroll in the plaza before St. Peter's Cathedral, or perhaps they're wandering down one of the canals of Venice.
Whatever
the case, he's no longer a brother of mine.
I just want nothing to do with
him. Okay.
There's absolutely no way we're going to let him live this one down.
Well, we do have
one-headed Schmaltzgesicht, but
we have one consolation, my brother.
Is that
he's going to miss tomorrow. And as every red-blooded American knows, tomorrow, which is September 19th, is National Talk Like a Pirate Day.
Is that
it
so?
It is truly so.
Arr-mateys. All right, well,
he'll pay a price.
I'm glad you let me on another juicy tidbit of cultural phenomena here. All right, well, so we do want to continue the program nonetheless.
We might
as
well.
And you have prepared fastidiously this topic about Jews and Christians and the relationship that we've had with our, kind of religious forebears.
Sort of brethren, you bet.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting because really we're going to, well, what happened? You remember the story we did on Corrie Ten Boom and The Hiding Place?
Mm-hmm.
And we've also examined Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and that's kind of two aspects of the Holocaust during World War II. Well, one of the things that happened as a result of that, a friend of mine who is a student at a literature class at some, I'll just say a local college, somewhere in the neighborhood, was having a lot of trouble and was talking about Christians taking care of Jews and hiding them in World War II. And the professor just came unglued and said, "Oh no, document that. There's no real cases of that." And we were a little intrigued by that, so we started doing some serious research and going online and stuff like that, and basically discovered that the documentation supports the fact that perhaps 250,000 Christians lost the war too, hiding and saving perhaps upwards of 2 million Jews.
Wow.
That's just not something you hear about.
Great research.
Well, it's been interesting. My brain is just stuffed at this point with names and numbers, and I kind of despaired how to present this to folks, but, you know, just, we might call this the Hiding Place Part 2,
okay.
Basically, and a little bit more broad picture of what really happened during the Holocaust in Europe, how the Jews really were, in large part, hidden and saved and smuggled out by the Christians in large numbers, really large numbers. Okay, so a little background here. I mean, we all remember from past programs and some of our readings and stuff that In the early times, I guess the first century, after the Lord, basically Christianity was viewed as a subset of Judaism.
Right. And first Christians were Jews.
Yeah, that's actually one reason
worshipped in the temple.
Yeah, and we even avoided persecution by the Roman Empire because they just, it's a Jewish sect, and we don't get those crazy people mad. They're just more trouble than they're worth. So after about 100 years, this kind of started to change, and what you saw, this Christian community kind of coming into its own, establishing its own identity. It sought to utilize some of the Greek philosophers to explain some biblical concepts, and used some of their, even some of the Roman philosophers. And as a result, it began to distance itself from Judaism. And, well, of course,
and
there's,
vice versa.
Yeah.
You guys really aren't part of us. You know, the whole thing with the AD 70 and the Sabbath.
It was inevitable. I mean, the whole nature of Christ's revelation to us really undercut the Mosaic law. And basically, it was the discovery that, gosh, we're just two completely different religions here. And so animosity and alienation grew over the years, and the Jews were still perceived kind of as the Christ killers. You know, that was not really an accurate portrayal, but nonetheless, some of the early Christian fathers that's just the best they could come up with philosophically, and they mistakenly kind of cultivated that awareness until Constantine took over, made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, and primarily just kept this whole anti-Semitic thing going, and that took us, gosh, into the Middle Ages. Even Islam, when they sprung up in the 7th century, basically continued that. They burned and killed and pillaged and chased Christians and Jews out of Arabia. They mellowed out later, after they'd kind of conquered everything and discovered that they could get some rather lucrative infidel taxes from these people. They kind of let them live and just collected their money, and that everything was hunky-dory. But in Western Europe, there tended to be a carryover of that perception that Jews were the enemies of Christians. And every time things kind of settled down, we'd convert a whole new tribe of barbarians, and they would wrestle, well, how are we going to demonstrate our true faithfulness to Christianity? I know, let's go out and burn some Jewish villages. Why not? It was a really bizarre continuing thing. And the Jews aren't completely innocent in this either. I mean, they're pretty stiff-necked and stubborn, as even the creator of the universe has said in a place or two.
Okay.
But truthfully, I mean, they did not contribute to a lessening of tension between the two communities. Well, golly, between Islam, between the barbarians in the Western Europe and the Byzantine Empire and the Eastern Europe, what Jews found themselves doing is migrating into Eastern Europe in large numbers, up into the Urals and Russia, and all as one of the few neighborhoods they could get by with and not get chased around and beat up on. Well, all this sort of continued, and in the Middle Ages, things just went to pot. The period between 1100, the start of the Crusades, and the Reformation at 1500, that 400-year period was just terrible for the Jews. The new fervor of the Christian kingdom, the new power of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody that had a political axe to grind would point to the Jews and say it's their fault. Didn't matter what it was.
Boy, and that's true. I can corroborate that. If something was wrong in society, well, let's blame the Jews because they're
handy. It continues today. Yeah. You bet. They don't assimilate well, and they're a handy scapegoat for anybody looking to, for a scapegoat. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that pop up first thing. During the plague, just because of the dietary restrictions the Jewish community had, during the bubonic plague, the Great Black Death that almost wiped out half of Europe in the 14th century, Jews were the primary scapegoats because they didn't eat and drink the same way that the rest of the European cities did. And so people would look at them, and they weren't getting as sick because they drank clean water and they avoided pork and things like that. So people began to accuse them of poisoning the wells, and that's where the plague came from.
Oh, no.
Oh gosh, 1,000 Jews would be killed here, 10,000 would be killed over there, 100,000 would be killed over here. It was an ugly time. It was just a bad time. Even when the Reformation dawned, Martin Luther, the great champion of the Reformation, was completely anti-Semitic. Neurotically anti-Semitic. So I don't know. This was just, it has never really been a good picture. But there at the Reformation kind of represented the low point. Since the Reformation, things have been getting better between Jews and Protestants. For one thing, there were so many of the Protestants persecuted by the church that really they started to feel a solidarity with persecutions of the Jews. Hmm. Protestant communities began to really encourage Jews to settle and protected them. Especially by the 1800s, civil rights were being returned to Jews all over Europe, the United States, in great large numbers. So things were really getting pretty good, except in Russia. And I don't know, is this the rise of Marxism? Could be. Who knows? It's hard to perceive some of these things. But basically, the pogroms, which were the persecution programs of the czars, started taking over. Everybody's seen Fiddler on the Roof. That's what this is all about. And interestingly enough, about the time of our Civil War, this is going on, this is what starts sending Jews in large number to Israel.
Really?
Yeah. And this is actually
the pogroms.
This is actually the birth of the Zionist movement. And around the turn of the century, the Russian intellectuals even begin writing up what are called the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is a complete fabrication. It says Jews want to take over the world and everything. And it wouldn't even really be important except that Hitler latched onto this. And what you see is, after, gosh, several centuries of real improvement in Christian relations, there in Russia and in Germany is just a real deterioration. And, you know, Hitler, golly, the rest is history. As he came to power, he really began to institute what everybody knows as the Holocaust between 1933 and 1939. In that six-year period, things went from just, you know, name-calling, and occasionally a Jew would get beat up, to pretty much the establishment of the ghettos, the formulation and building the concentration camps, the institution mm-hmm. of the mass killings. By 1939, 1940, things were in full swing. Okay, now that brings us to our story here. Now, Hitler has invaded, both Poland and the Low Countries in Europe. You know, Britain and the United States are still kind of wondering what to do. Britain is fighting for its life. But here in the Low Countries, Holland and Denmark, this is where we first hear about Corrie ten Boom and her family. And she was in no way rare or uncommon. She and her little group, as a matter of fact, were credited with saving over 800 Jews. And there were 1,000 groups like hers all over Amsterdam and Holland. As a matter of fact, the Christian folks that took care of Anne Frank, my Skype, and her husband, same thing. This is, there were these little cells all over the place. And I need to explain that nobody really set out to do this. This was not a
program that somebody invented.
You don't wake up in the morning and say, well, I think I'll just go spit in the Gestapo's eye this morning. I'm feeling good. I'm feeling burly. That's just not how it happened. I like Corey's family. Basically what happened, you'd get an opportunity. You'd be faced in a situation where suddenly, well, a Jew, and can they spend the night at your house? And you say, oh, gosh, okay, yeah. And you'd let them spend the night. And then it becomes increasingly apparent they can't escape, they can't get out. Because basically in 1939, the Western Allies closed immigration to Jews. They wouldn't let them come in. There's that horrible story of the 600 Jews in the ship, the SS St. Louis, leaving Europe, looking all over the world, sailing to the United States, to Cuba, all over Europe, looking for asylum.
Really?
They were turned back. They were refused.
Oh, so I didn't know that story.
They went back to Belgium, and most of them went to their deaths in the concentration camps. Yeah, the Western nations failed utterly to step up to the plate, unlike the individual Christians. In Denmark, when they made them wear the yellow stars, King Christian showed up the next morning on his morning horseback ride wearing a yellow star on his royal robes. And by that afternoon, just about everybody in Copenhagen had yellow stars sewed onto their clothing. In Holland itself, in the town of Haarlem, Christians got together and actually rioted when the Gestapo tried to round up the Jews that were living down there. The Gestapo and SS didn't know what to do. They had to pull back and actually send in the armored divisions. Needless to say, this was not a good way to fight the Nazi regime. And so that's when people like Corrie and her family and my Skype and a bunch of other folks began to take Jews into their house. There was just no other way to do it. And golly, that wasn't even in France, villages all over France would do the same thing. I mean, if the people that worked for the government, the Vichy government, would falsify documents, they'd lose orders from Berlin that said round up the Jews in such and such a village. Mm-hmm. Those orders would just kind of, gosh, disappear, you know. Bureaucracy really was poor there. And there were active things as well. I mean, there were groups of Catholic nuns that would go out and troll the countryside for lost, hidden children hiding from the persecution.
Wow.
They would drag them, hide them under their habits, take them back to the monastery. All over Europe, monasteries and convents were stuffed with Jews. They were just packed, you know, in every corner and hidden.
But there was no way for them to get out because all the borders were closed to any immigration.
Very much. I mean, it just you might have smuggled out, but it was, you not only had to leave Europe illegally, you had to get into another country illegally,
right,
because no
right.
country was taking them. And by this time, this is like the early 1940s, and it's becoming increasingly clear what's going on. You know, the first information about the death camps are coming out. And fear is really starting to rise. And yet, boy, Christians all over Europe, every country really, are increasingly just taking the Jews into their homes. As I was saying, in the south of France, one wonderful story, the village of Le Chabon, a pastor and his wife just started taking in some of the children that were passing through the area as the Jews were trying to escape. And ended up, I mean, they start putting them in farms and barns, and they end up hiding 5,000 children The Gestapo come into town with busloads because they've heard the rumors. We need to find these children. And everybody just shakes their heads, you know, and this is the whole town. All it would have taken is one there to blow the whistle. And the whole town just kind of goes dummy. And 5,000 kids hid in till the end of the war. And that's a pretty good story. That's a pretty good Christian witness.
Yeah, yeah,
because basically, one of the things we're finding, and one of the things that makes it so difficult to track this down, Pat, is the fact that most of the Christians that hid them were discovered and killed. We're just, the way the numbers keep growing now, because old Jews simply remember the story and are remembering the names of the people. Yad Vashem, the memorial to the Holocaust in Israel, in Jerusalem, is one of the primary record keepers of this. And every year they get thousands of new names as the old people remember and send it in, realizing how important it is now, because those records are almost all but lost. Because look at it, I mean, you know, if you were hiding Jews, if you were a Christian hiding Jews, you're an amateur. You know, you don't know anything about this. I think of it. You know, you need the physical space. You need to somehow, in a society that's monitoring and rationing food tickets, you need to get enough food to feed those people. You need to get water to them. What if they get sick?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what if they die? How do you get rid of the body if they die? What do you do with waste products? You know, they had to sit in there. Boy, if you've never seen the movie Anne Frank, just drop everything else today and run down somewhere and rent it. That'll give you a good idea. People just had to sit in one position without moving, making any noise, all day long. And the only time they could move around was quietly at night. No lights, no nothing. It was, we can barely imagine what it would take to survive under those conditions. And most of them didn't. If they weren't smuggled out and didn't escape, most of them ended up getting caught and taken off to the camps. Italy was another good spot. I have to give the Catholic Church credit there, that they are the one institutional church that really responded in a big way. Pope Pius XII has been,
fairly well maligned.
Yeah, and you know, that's kind of like saying that Abraham Lincoln didn't do enough to free the slaves. You know, hello, like, get a clue, people. You don't go toe-to-toe with Adolf Hitler if you want to wake up breathing in the morning. And so basically, the Pope just started sending messages out to all his people and saying, you know what, this is wrong, and we just don't need to hide these people. And the Catholics really put up a good record of hiding Jews all over Europe. Gosh, there's so many great stories. I can't even start, but one of the guys in Munich was the cardinal, Mike Fallober. And when they were starting to drag the Jews off, he jumped up in the cart and took the copy of the Torah out, put it in his own truck, and just told the lynch mob to get lost. And they didn't dare touch him. I mean, he's a pretty powerful guy. But that's fairly gutsy. To take the Torah and the rabbi out and get them to safety in the face of a screaming mob. There are 10,000 stories like that.
You know, my own mom-in-law was spending the war in Czechoslovakia, what was then Czechoslovakia, and her folks hid some. She was a teenager at the time during World War II. And they hid some Jews, and I don't know, but of course, I didn't get all the details. I think we did have her say the story into a tape recorder before she went to be with the Lord. But anyway, fascinating. I mean, there was another family. It was not all that unusual, but it was very scary. I mean, they were in great danger themselves, you know, from the Germans, and then of course the Russians coming in by the end of the war from the east. Everybody had to clear out, and well, I don't want to go into that, but anyway, I just am saying, yeah, in my own family, here's an example.
Almost everybody can. I the websites that are increasingly available that are dealing with this are really interesting, because one of the things we're witnessing now, Pat, you know, with the rise of postmodern pluralism, is historic revisionism. And I don't want to bore people with big words, but basically what that means is, like George Orwell wrote about in 1984, you know, you just rewrite the textbooks to say whatever you want. And there's an increasing pressure to downplay the Holocaust in textbooks. It's called Holocaust denial. And quite frankly, there are people out there who are standing up and saying, well, it never happened. It just never happened.
That's gross. How can they do that?
Well, that's, you know, you repeat a thing enough times and people start to believe it. And if anybody thinks that our textbooks in our schools are giving an accurate representation of history, well, you haven't looked through those textbooks in a few years, I'll tell you. This is something that people need to be aware of. Revisionism is rampant, and basically it's not that hard to rewrite history. You know, if you control the media, if you control the publishing houses, you know, you control the teachers' unions, boy, just over a period of years, you can change the whole character.
Have they been to Krakow? Have they been to Dachau?
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, those city bullet holes in the wall are there. The ovens are still there. You can see them.
Great-grandmas and great-grandpas still walking around with tattoos in their forearms. Not many. They're dying off fast, which is why we need to remember these things. I don't know. It's interesting. One of the biggest lessons in looking at all this, Pat, is the fact that where governments completely failed to act. You know, the Western governments just did the ostrich thing and buried their heads in the sand, yeah. Completely closed their doors to the Jews. Most of the churches institutionally just kind of buried their heads in the sand, said, we don't want to deal with it, with the exception of a few. Like I say, the Confessing Church in Germany, that was Dietrich Bonhoeffer's mm-hmm. old outfit. You know, some of those folks stood up, but boy, the institutions of man failed utterly to meet this need. The only level upon which this need was met adequately was by individual men and women, almost exclusively Christian. You know, there were a few that would hide Jews for money, but you know, when the Gestapo is going to take you off, kill you, your family, everybody your family met, ever heard of or talked to, that's too much risk. Basically, the only thing that makes that worthwhile is a Christian in a situation recognizing they have a clear choice between faith and fear, and not giving into the fear, and simply in faith doing what they know Christ would have them do. And that's increasingly the evidence that's being raised and brought to light in this time.
Well, I thank you for doing all that research there and the websites and calling that to mind. It's important to remember, and it's important to see that, you know, there are times when you have to just rise up and do the godly thing. And that was certainly one of those occasions, and I'm glad, like I say, that you called it to our attention here today.
Well, absolutely. Huh? You know, we don't even need to be heroes, Pat. We just need not to run away when it's time to stand firm.
Good word, brother. Well, Matt, thanks for doing it today. He was our friend, but, you know, Chris White. But, Chris is away on a trip to Europe. Anyway, we'll welcome you and Chris, I think, back next month when we do another program. Do you remember what it is just off the top of your head right now?
I believe it's the Cappadocian Fathers.
Oh, well.
The three monks that got things going in Turkey and Eastern Mediterranean in the early days of the church.
Good old Gregory Nazianzus. I like to say the name, if nothing else. So, anyway, Matt, Lord bless you, buddy. And
thank you, Patrick.
Great look again into our family history. So we have more music coming up here on K-Dub. And, of course, at 1 o'clock, it's time for the news. And Randy Carlson, stay with us.